I'm Simon Belfield, and I'm a director in the Regulatory Compliance and Investigations team at DWF, based in their Manchester office. I'm also joined by my colleague, Jeremy Bird.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Bird. I'm a senior associate in the Regulatory Compliance and Investigations team, specialising in private prosecutions.
So today we're going to talk everything private prosecutions, an area which has become something of a hot topic recently. In this webinar, we are going to discuss everything from how a private prosecution works to the raft of recent high-profile attempts of taking a private prosecution, before concluding with our thoughts as to how we see the future landscape in this particular area of law. So I'll now turn to Jeremy to introduce the topic of private prosecutions and explain what is a private prosecution.
What is a private prosecution? Well, in a nutshell, it's a useful alternate means of recourse which is open to anyone who has been the victim of a criminal offence. It seems clear that as police budgets continue to bite and pressures on the judicial system continue to increase, many people are being forced to fund their own actions in the pursuit of justice. A private prosecution therefore allows an individual or a corporate to bring criminal proceedings themselves, having exhausted all other avenues open to them. The case of Gourier and the Union of Post Office Workers, 1978, Lord Wilberforce held, the individual in such circumstances who wishes to see the law enforced has a remedy of his own. He can bring a private prosecution. This historical right remains a valuable constitutional safeguard against inertia or partiality on the part of the authority. The power to bring a private prosecution in this country is enshrined in law under Section 6(1) of the Prosecution of Offences Act 1985. The legislation applies in England and Wales only, not in Scotland or Northern Ireland. By way of comparison within the UK, let's briefly take a look at Scotland, as private prosecutions are extremely unusual. In fact, there's only been two successful private prosecutions in Scotland in the 20th century. Back in 1982, the case of Carol X, a Glasgow woman prosecuted three men whom she claimed raped her. One man was found guilty of rape, the other two of indecent assault. It was interesting to note that the defence lawyers gave their services pro bono. And further back in time, in 1909, there was a fraud case involving the shipment of coal and fraudulent transactions. In fact, the last high-profile attempt at a private prosecution in Scotland was the Glasgow bin lorry accident, which took place in 2014. Moving on to the facts of the case. At 2:30 p.m. on the 22nd of December 2014, 58-year-old Harry Clark suffered an episode of neurocardiogenic syncope. In other words, he fainted whilst at the wheel of his 26-ton Glasgow City Council bin lorry on Queen Street, Glasgow. 19 seconds later, the vehicle had mounted the pavement, which was filled with Christmas shoppers, and had come to a rest against the Millennium Hotel in George Square. Six people were killed and 15 people were injured. The incident was treated as a road traffic accident and was so investigated by the police and not the Health and Safety Executive. On the 25th of February 2015, it was announced that no criminal charges would be brought against Mr. Clark, as he didn't have the necessary criminal state of mind required for a criminal conviction, and that no breaches of health and safety law had taken place. On the 22nd of July 2015, the fatal accident inquiry began at Glasgow Sheriff Court. Mr. Clark's history of fainting and dizziness became apparent, as it was revealed that he had suffered a similar episode at the wheel of a bus back in 2010. During the inquiry, the family of one of the victims requested an adjournment in proceedings to pursue a private prosecution against Mr. Clark for dangerous driving. However, this request was opposed by one of the families, but supported by the others. The motion was subsequently dropped, but the intention had been noted by the court. Mr. Clark was then warned by the sheriff of the potential for answering questions and incriminating himself. As such, he subsequently declined to answer all but a few questions. However, he did later apologise. 5 weeks later, on the 28th of August 2015, the inquiry was adjourned. The majority of the blame was placed on Mr. Clark's decision to cover up his history of blackouts. He had repeatedly lied in order to gain and retain jobs. However, the Lord Advocate, Frank Mulholland, reiterated his decision not to prosecute Mr. Clark. It was revealed that Mr. Clark had deliberately misled and deceived his doctors, had lied on health declarations, and had deliberately concealed relevant information from the DVLA. He had lied about his medical history and had been a failure by both the company doctor and his own GP that had enabled Mr. Clark to change his account of events. On the 7th of December 2015, following findings of the FAI, the family, who had lost three members, announced their intention to pursue a private prosecution. They also criticised the Crown Office decision not to prosecute Mr. Clark. On the 27th of January 2016, Frank Mulholland confirmed the decision not to support a private prosecution due to insufficient evidence. Comments made included, "There are no findings in the determination that undermine the decision not to prosecute the driver. There was no finding that the driver knew or ought to have known that he was unfit to drive. It is important to note that the sheriff was considering evidence at an FAI where a lesser standard of proof is required and where more relaxed rules of evidence apply. A criminal prosecution requires sufficient evidence to the much higher standard beyond reasonable doubt." On the 9th of March 2016, legal aid was granted to the families to pursue a private prosecution in light of the unique and special circumstances of this case, as it raised fundamental questions that had not previously been tested in case law, and Scottish ministers believed it was in the public interest that all the parties were adequately represented. It was interesting to note that at the time legal aid was also granted to Mr. Clark. It's worth noting the issue of whether there was exceptional circumstances to justify a private prosecution was a matter for the High Court alone and did not form part of the legal aid decision. However, unfortunately for the families of the victims, on the 9th of December 2016, the private prosecution against Mr. Clark failed, as senior judges at the appeal court rejected the case, warning that to allow it would open the floodgates for similar prosecutions. So how have we arrived at this situation, Simon?
One of the key reasons why we are seeing an increase in private prosecutions is due to the various cutbacks that we have seen and will no doubt continue to see within the public sector. These cuts have led to a prioritisation of crimes, a lack of resources to investigate crimes, and in particular, a lack of dedicated economic crime teams and a lack of progress to tackle in certain circumstances, cybercrime. It is our view that this is only going to get worse as a result of COVID, as we see a bumpy ride ahead for the already under pressure criminal justice system. So what do the statistics say? Well, since the Conservatives came to power in 2010, police budgets have been cut and office numbers have fallen by more than 20,000. There's been a 15% reduction in police numbers since 2010. And many people claim that funding reductions have jeopardised public safety. In 2019, the government pledged to recruit 20,000 additional police officers over the following 3 years. However, it is now thought that police may be facing a new era of austerity, with some forces potentially facing their worst ever annual budget cuts, fuelled by the coronavirus crisis. The Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has warned the funding crisis endangers the government's pledge to recruit 20,000 extra officers to fight crime and risks leaving police doing their jobs with one hand tied behind their backs. A lack of serious resources also means the police have to concentrate on responding to serious crimes, which is what the government said that they would have to do if they suffered large staff absences due to coronavirus. In 2019, it was revealed that only one in 200 police officers are dedicated to investigating fraud, despite it accounting for more than one third of all crimes, with most forces having less than half of 1% of their officers allocated to fraud cases, and some have none at all. This lack of capacity and capability has an adverse effect on the quality of service provided to victims of fraud. Even before coronavirus, in February 2020, a new report said that the public are losing faith in the criminal justice system and have rumbled that police do not have the capacity to investigate common crimes, such as burglaries or car crime, and have given up reporting incidents to the police, therefore. The constabulary inspector said a suspect was a suspect was charged in just 7.8% of crimes in England and Wales in the year to March 2019. It is not just police resources causing concern for the public, but the court system is also struggling to cope with its huge backlog of cases, which has only increased throughout COVID-19. As of 6th of September 2020, 550,000 cases awaited court, including more than 40,000 serious cases scheduled for the Crown Court. There have also been cuts to legal aid and reductions in court support services and administrative facilities in recent years, which even before the pandemic meant that large numbers of trials were unable to proceed due to the lack of administrative support staff and consequently empty courtrooms. So with these cutbacks prevalent and with us for the foreseeable future, how do you take matters into your own hand and bring a private prosecution? I'll pass you back to Jeremy, who will explain.
Thanks, Simon. So how does one actually bring a private prosecution? Well, the mechanics are rather like a criminal prosecution. One has to gather evidence, investigate, and establish if a criminal offence has been committed. However, as the private prosecutor doesn't have police powers to arrest, search, and interview, what does he have in his armory to deploy to enable him to assist with the investigative process? Well, on the slide on page 6, there's a non-exhaustive list which one can use dependent on the given situation. So one is able to utilise the civil courts, perhaps to obtain Norwich Pharmacal orders in order to request disclosure of material from third parties. If there has been an investigation undertaken by the police that hasn't progressed, one can contact the police for disclosure. There is the possibility of instructing private investigators to trace witnesses and gather evidence. One can use data mining, again, as another evidence-gathering tool. One can obtain summonses from the criminal courts to compel witnesses to give evidence. One can also obtain witness statements as prima facie evidence. Put together, this information will lead to the drafting of charges in order to prepare a case summary and obtain witness statements. The purpose of undertaking this investigation stage and then reviewing the evidence obtained is to satisfy the CPS code for prosecutors. Essentially, there are two limbs to the code. Both limbs need to be satisfied. The first limb, is there enough reliable and credible evidence against the defendant to provide a realistic prospect of conviction? And secondly, is it in the public interest for the CPS to bring the case to court? Once the code has been satisfied, proceedings then commence at the magistrate's court by what's called the laying of information. The court will then consider whether the offence is known to law, whether the ingredients of the offence are met, whether it is in time, and whether the allegation is vexatious in its nature. Once a summons has been issued, it is then served on the defendant and the prosecution proceeds in the normal way, as it would a public prosecution. So, Simon, what are the pros and cons of bringing a private prosecution?
Let's look at the benefits of bringing a private prosecution. Well, firstly, you are in control. It's not a government agency that's in control. It's you. Then you have access to a better resourced, more focused and efficient team rather than any other public prosecution. A team, you might think, also has a specific skill set in relation to dealing with issues of disclosure, for example. Then in relation to costs, you're able to claim back costs from the court, even if you lose or withdraw from the proceedings, so long as the private prosecution has been brought with good cause and has not been brought vexatiously or maliciously. And Jeremy will explain more about this later on in this seminar. In relation to defendant's costs, unlike other proceedings, generally you will not have to pay the defendant costs if you lose your case. And in relation to speed, unlike civil proceedings, matters can be brought to court very quickly. There are also wider powers of punishment. Criminal convictions carry a stigma, whilst criminal courts have wider powers to punish, from fines and confiscation to also imprisonment. And there's also an advantage in being able to run parallel civil proceedings if you can afford it. It may be possible to use the success in the criminal court to achieve a better result in the civil proceedings, where the standards of proof are lower. The criminal proceedings would also be markedly cheaper than the civil proceedings, and lengthy disputes in relation to disclosure, for example, will be best aired in the criminal court, who are used to dealing with this type of disclosure and these types of investigations. So let's also then look at the pitfalls and the risks. If we move on to slide 9. Any private prosecution that fails to satisfy the code risks being taken over by the CPS and discontinued. The CPS will also take over the conduct of any private prosecution and discontinue where either the evidential sufficiency or public interest stage is not met. The CPS are also likely to take over where any private prosecution is likely to damage the interests of justice. The Director of Public Prosecutions can take over any cases and stop them if it is considered vexatious or malicious. And a private prosecution can also be stopped if it interferes with any other case or is considered not to be in the public interest. The disclosure obligations are onerous, and there is a duty to retain and record all materials which could be relevant. The same disclosure tests under CPIA apply as they do for the CPS. And finally, there are implications if you do not get it right. Proceedings can be stayed, and importantly, costs can be awarded against you in those narrow circumstances. So to bring this subject to life, I'm now going to ask Jeremy to go through a case study in some detail. Over to you, Jeremy.
Question arises, does the issuing of a caution preclude the bringing of a private prosecution? Please note, this is not to be confused with a conditional caution, which is a caution with conditions attached. A simple caution is a formal warning given by the police for low-level, mainly first-time offending, without resorting to a prosecution. This is an operational decision for the police, and in some instances the CPS, and is based on the specific circumstances of each individual case. Chapter 4 of Archbold 2019, Criminal Pleading Evidence and Practice, it states, a private prosecution for an offence for which the defendant has received a formal police caution will be an abusive process where the terms of the caution represented that he would not be prosecuted without reference to the possibility of a private prosecution. And that's referenced in the case of Jones and Worley, 2007. But not where the defendant was told, when cautioned, that he may nonetheless face a private prosecution. That's the case of Hayter and L, 1998. Or was told nothing on the point. That's the case of R. Loudon versus Gateshead Magistrates Court. Similarly, Blackstone's Criminal Practice 2019 states, in DPP versus Alexander, 2011 case, the Divisional Court considered the effects of a caution in the context of the doctrine of autrefois. Stanley Burton LJ stated, a caution is not a conviction for the purposes of those defences, notwithstanding that a caution will only be administered if the accused person admits his guilt. The principles of autrefois convict and autrefois acquit are applicable only where there has been a finding by a court of guilt or innocence. They have no application to an extrajudicial procedure, such as the administration of a simple caution. However, His Lordship went on to say at paragraph 9 that where criminal conduct has been the subject of an agreed caution, in the absence of good reason for it to be the subject of a subsequent prosecution, such a prosecution will generally constitute an abuse of the process of the court. He added that examples of cases where a prosecution might be justified despite the earlier administration of a caution include instances where information or evidence is obtained subsequent to the caution, such as details of an injury to a victim significantly exceeding what was previously known. Turning specifically now to the case of R. Loudon versus Gateshead Magistrates Court, a case that DWF were involved in. AL was working as the night receptionist at the Premier Inn in the Newcastle Metro Centre, which was owned and operated by Whitbread PLC, when he was assaulted by a gassed DW on the evening of Saturday the 7th of March 2015. AL was knocked unconscious and required hospital treatment as a result of the injuries he had sustained. DW was subsequently arrested by the police and admitted the assault. He was given a police caution as, according to one of the arresting officers, this was his first offence and that was all he was ever going to get. Following on from this, Whitbread, in accordance with their internal protection of employees policy, determined that they would instruct DWF to pursue a private prosecution against DW. Evidence was gathered and an investigation was undertaken, and on satisfying the two limbs of the code, information was laid at Gateshead Magistrates Court with a view to summoning DW to court to face a charge of Section 47 assault. The district judge was satisfied as to the formalities and that the evidence disclosed the essential ingredients of an offence known to English law. However, interestingly, she held that it would be unreasonable for the summons to be issued, as DW had been the subject of a simple caution, which AL had not sought to challenge by way of judicial review. The DJ regarded the issue of the summons as an appropriate route to challenging the decision taken and disposal determined. Having considered this decision, DWF sought to judicially review, firstly, the decision of Northumbria Police to issue a caution to DW, and secondly, the decision of Gateshead Magistrates Court to refuse to issue a summons. The case was heard on the 16th of November 2016. Whilst the Administrative Court held that it was entirely reasonable for the police to administer a caution to DW, they nevertheless upheld DWF's second claim in relation to the decision of Gateshead Magistrates Court not to issue the summons. The court held that it was an error by the district judge to conclude that a private prosecution was precluded by the existence of a prior police caution, and that the district judge had no reasonable grounds to decline to issue a summons in this occasion. Blake J. reiterated at paragraph 54 of the judgment that the existence of a simple caution administered by the police or the CPS was not in itself a bar to a private prosecution being brought. If an assurance was given in the course of administering the caution, that there would be no prosecution. The court therefore ordered that the district judge's decision be quashed and the decision to refuse to issue the summons must be reconsidered. Gateshead Magistrates Court Gateshead Magistrates Court subsequently reconsidered their decision and the summons was issued. It's also perhaps worth noting those comments made by Davis LJ at paragraph 53 in this case as a timely reminder for the UK's police forces to look to adopt standardised caution forms to ensure that MOJ guidance is adhered to. He stated, "Most of the problems that have arisen in this case derive from the failure of the local police to adopt a standard form of caution which follows the 2013 guidance. There is no good reason for such a failure, but I would go further than that. I find it very hard to see why there is not a common standard form of caution to be applicable to all police forces. Someone may care not only to think about this, but also actually do something about it. Inconsistency between police forces serves no purpose whatsoever."
So in order to understand why we are where we are with private prosecutions, it's important to understand how we've got here. Jeremy will now set out that history.
What has the last 25 years shown us? Well, over the next couple of slides and next couple of minutes, I'm going to look at a number of cases. Some have been successful, some have not been successful, but they clearly show there's been a sea of change over recent years in this ever-developing area of the law. September 1994, the parents of Stephen Lawrence, who was murdered on the 22nd of April 1993, launched a private prosecution against three of those individuals accused of his murder: Neil Acourt, Gary Dobson, and David Norris. However, all three were acquitted following directions by the trial judge due to unreliable identification evidence in April 1996. However, subsequently in 2012, Gary Dobson and David Norris were found guilty of murder. In 1998, the Hillsborough Family Support Group initiated a private prosecution against two former police officers, David Duckenfield and Bernard Murray, on charges of manslaughter and misconduct. After 16 hours of deliberation, a majority verdict direction, and then a further 5 hours deliberation, Murray was acquitted. The jury were then discharged after being unable to reach a verdict on Duckenfield. The judge refused an application for a retrial, and a stay was then imposed in 2000, which halted any further legal proceedings against David Duckenfield. However, the CPS successfully applied to lift that stay in 2018, and David Duckenfield was prosecuted for 95 counts of gross negligence manslaughter. However, he was acquitted of all of those offences in November 2019. In 2012, the Federation Against Copyright Theft brought a successful private prosecution against Anton Vickerman, who received a 4-year prison sentence for making movies available on his website, surfthechannel.com. And in 2014, Kellan Somaya was convicted of 9 counts of fraud and received a custodial sentence of 8 years after swindling investors out of £13.5 million. The private prosecution had been brought by one of his former victims, Merle Merchandani. In October 2014, after the collapse of a civil claim, AXA Insurance then successfully brought a private prosecution against a man who had claimed £100,000 for a work injury. X had a pre-existing back injury, but had never actually had an accident. The defendant was convicted under Fraud Act offences and received a 3-year prison sentence, suspended for 2 years. H.H. Day Clark stated that AXA was entirely justified in bringing the private prosecution in order to send a message of deterrence to those individuals attempting to defraud the insurance industry. In March 2017, Accidents Exchange successfully brought a private prosecution against two men, Adam Islam and Mohammed Abu Kaya, following a road traffic collision between two vehicles in London in 2014. An insurance claim followed, as one might expect. However, investigations carried out uncovered evidence that the new claim was in fact fraudulent, as both drivers actually knew each other. And after being charged, both pleaded guilty to Fraud Act offences. One of them was sentenced to 18 months custody, the other a 12-month suspended sentence. In April 2017, there was a bid to privately prosecute Tony Blair over the Iraq War. However, this was blocked by the government. A former chief of staff of the Iraqi army, General Abdul Wahid Shannon R. Ribat, attempted to bring a private prosecution against Tony Blair in relation to the Iraq War, based on the Chilcot Inquiry report. It sought to prosecute the former Prime Minister, his then Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, and the Attorney General at the time, Lord Goldsmith, for the crime of aggression, according to legal papers seen by The Guardian. However, in July 2017, the High Court ruled that Tony Blair should not be prosecuted for his role in the Iraq War, stated that there was no crime of aggression in English law under which the former Prime Minister could be charged. In April 2017, 5 police officers appeared at Wolverhampton Crown Court in a private prosecution brought by a man who claimed they roughed him up, then staged a cover-up. Jobless courier Neil Wilkes stated police were called to his home after his tipsy wife Marie fell down the stairs because her daughter mistakenly thought that she was being attacked. In May 2017, Oliver Colville, who was the Conservative candidate in Plymouth, was privately prosecuted over alleged electoral fraud and expenses claims made during the 2015 general election. And in 2018, the parents of baby Alfie Evans, Kate James and Tom Evans, made headlines around the world with their legal battle concerning Alfie's treatments for a rare degenerative brain condition at Alderhay Hospital. Amongst all of the media frenzy as to whether the hospital could withdraw treatment against the parents' wishes for Alfie, or whether his parents could take him to Italy to receive specialist treatment, was the question as to whether it would be possible for his parents to privately prosecute the hospital and or senior individuals for the withdrawal of any treatment which was at the time keeping Alfie alive. However, after an 18-month battle, having exhausted all their legal avenues before the Court of Appeal, Alfie's life support was turned off on the 28th of April 2018. On the 11th of June 2018, in what was thought to be the largest fraud in Britain to be successfully prosecuted privately, Paul Sultana, a former car dealer, was jailed for 8 years for a multi-million pound investment fraud after the company he defrauded brought a private prosecution. Sultana was part of a team of fraudsters which persuaded the offshore engineering company Allseas to give them £88 million to invest by promising extremely high rates of return. Surprisingly, the CPS had initially decided that there was insufficient evidence to prosecute, and after the case, said it would seek to learn lessons from the outcome. Earlier this year, we saw the retailer Boots making legal history by becoming the first corporate victim to privately prosecute a shoplifter after Nicholas Richards stole £170 worth of perfume. A private security guard detained him, but the police officer later let him go with a ticking off. Boots were rightly concerned by the decision not to arrest and charge Richards, and so commenced a private prosecution. Richards subsequently pleaded guilty to the charges. In May this year, it was reported that the family of Harry Dunn, a 19-year-old killed after being hit by a car driven by Anne Sokoulos, the wife of a UN intelligence officer, were considering bringing a private prosecution against the Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, for alleged misconduct in public office and perverting the course of justice. The Guardian stated, Mr. Dunn's family claim that Raab did not have the authority to allow Anne Sokoulos to return to the US after the incident, and that he misled Parliament in statements following her return to the US. It's clear that due to cost implications, which is something that I will discuss in due course, we've also seen a number of crowdfunding attempts at private prosecutions over the last few years. On the 25th of April 2014, 70-year-old Michael Mason was hit by Gail Purcell's vehicle while cycling on London's Regent Street. Mr. Mason died in hospital 19 days later after never having regained consciousness. The case was referred to the Met Police, where they decided to take no further action. Mr. Mason's family, not prepared to take no for an answer, pursued justice by commencing a private prosecution. The prosecutor in the case was the Cycling Defence Fund, a subsidiary of Cycling UK, a charity which acts to raise awareness of the laws relating to cycling in the UK. The costs incurred in bringing the prosecution were met entirely through crowdfunding, and over £80,000 was raised, but unfortunately, the defendant was acquitted. In 2014, a major fund to help families of British soldiers murdered by the IRA in the 1982 Hyde Park bombing was launched to bring the main suspect to justice. Relatives wanted to raise enough funds to bring a private prosecution against John Downey after he walked free from the Old Bailey. Their crowdfunding campaign was backed by The Sun and generated hundreds of donations towards the total amount. November 2017 saw the first crowd-funded private prosecution for rape being launched. Emily Hunt, who waived her statutory right to anonymity, made a complaint of rape in 2015. And following a decision by the CPS not to prosecute the man concerned, Christopher Killick, Ms. Hunt aimed to raise sufficient funds through crowdfunding to finance a private prosecution. In August 2020, Mr. Killick, who previously pleaded guilty to voyeurism, was given a 13-month community order and fined £2,000. He was also ordered to pay Ms. Hunt £5,000 in compensation and put on the sexual offenders register for 5 years. The recent and much publicised attempt by Marcus Ball, founder of Brexit Justice Limited, to bring a private prosecution against our current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, resulted in a media frenzy, the likes of which had not been seen before. Mr. Ball had sought to prosecute Mr. Johnson over allegations he committed misconduct in a public office by misleading the public by allegedly telling lies during the 2016 referendum on Brexit. Mr. Ball raised over £300,000 through online crowdfunding to bring the private prosecution last year in 2019. After the District Judge Margot Coleman issued summons in May 2019 for Mr. Johnson, who was then a leadership hopeful, to attend Westminster Magistrates Court to face three allegations of misconduct in the public office. However, on appeal, the High Court overturned this decision and quashed the summons which had been issued, stating that the case was the culmination of a politically driven process. The failed proceedings led to stories of Mr. Ball facing financial ruin with debts of over £200,000. However, Mr. Ball vowed to keep fighting and judicially review the High Court's ruling. In June 2020, Mahsa Taliafar, a law graduate, attempted to raise funds in order to bring a private prosecution against Dominic Cummings for allegedly breaking lockdown laws and breaching the health protection coronavirus regs 2020. This case seemed to make as many headlines for the subject matter as for the advice given. Having raised over £40,000 and instructed her legal team, an initial advice on prospects from Ben Douglas Jones QC was published online, which seemed to suggest there was a case to answer. However, this was quickly dispelled when, amongst others, the secret barrister sought to point out that the regs specifically precluded the bringing of a private prosecution. Separately, it was reported in the Gazette that solicitors in Merseyside had also taken the first steps in bringing a private prosecution against Dominic Cummings for alleged driving offences committed on his trip to Barnard Castle. And information was laid at Peterlee Magistrates Court in County Durham to begin that process. Most recently, it was reported that Nazir Afzal, the former regional chief prosecutor, was supporting another group of UK citizens who were hoping to have Dominic Cummings reinvestigated and prosecuted for breaching coronavirus regulations. Afzal had apparently urged the police and the CPS to pursue a case against Cummings, failing which he would consider launching a private prosecution on behalf of every citizen whose goodwill and generosity led them to make painful sacrifices in order to comply with the law and protect their fellow citizens. Seems abundantly clear that the increased media attention surrounding private prosecutions in recent months has naturally piqued the public's interest. This seems to have come about through a combination of factors, including police budget cuts, the knock-on effect and increased pressures on our criminal justice system, coupled with a perception by many people who feeling marginalised with those in or with power, that there seems to be one rule for them and another rule for everyone else. This in turn may well have led to an increase in awareness of this legislation that is open to all. As I mentioned before, with the increase in crowdfunding cases, it's important that we spend a couple of minutes talking about the cost regime involved in private prosecutions. The principle is that as long as the private prosecution is properly brought, even if it ultimately fails and the defendant is acquitted and is not deemed vexatious in its nature, a claim for prosecution costs to be recovered from central funds can be made. It is important to note, though, that any application for recovery of costs can only relate to those incurred after the summons has been laid before the magistrate's court. Costs can be recovered from central funds in respect of either weight and indictable-only offences, but not in relation to summary-only offences. You're also not usually required to pay the defendant's costs if you lose a private prosecution. The law in relation to cost orders is set out in Section 17 of the Prosecution of Offences Act 1985 and is summarised at paragraph 1.305 in Volume 1 of Stone's Justice Manual, which states, "Costs from central funds, prosecution cost order. A prosecution cost order from central funds for a private prosecution in proceedings in a magistrate's court for an indictable offence will generally be made, but the court may decline to make a prosecution cost order if, for example, the prosecution was started unreasonably." Section 17(1)(a) of the POA provides for the payments from central funds of the costs of a private prosecutor in any proceedings in respect of an indictable offence. Section 17(1)(b) provides for payment from central funds in any proceedings before a divisional court of the Queen's Bench Division or the Supreme Court in respect of a summary offence. The relevant practice direction, Costs in Criminal Proceedings 2015 and CPR, also provides support for the fact that an order must be made, save where there is good reason for not doing so. For example, where proceedings have been instituted or continued without good cause. The issue of recovery rights was brought to the fore in the recent case decision of Fusion Limited versus Senior Courts Cost Office 2019. This case has helpfully provided further guidance in respect of the extent of cost recovery by a private prosecutor from central funds. The case arose out of a successful private prosecution by a letting agent of one of its directors for a fraud-related offence. An order was made by the trial judge under Section 17 of the POA for the reasonable cost of the prosecutor to be paid out of central funds. Following determination, less than half of those cost claims were allowed. On appeal, this was increased but still left the claimant considerably out of pocket. After an unsuccessful appeal to the taxing master, the company appealed to the High Court, which in disagreeing with the determining officer's findings made the following points. Firstly, it was reasonable for the complainant to instruct the solicitors they did. Lane J ruled that the issue was not whether there were other local solicitors who might have been able to take on the case more cheaply, but whether it was reasonable in all circumstances for the London firm, which specialises in private prosecutions, to have been instructed instead. And secondly, there was no legal justification for pinning the prosecutor's recoverable costs to the level which would have been incurred by the CPS. In making that finding, the judge reiterated the important role played by private prosecutors within the constitutional framework and stated that the right to bring such a case should not be reserved for those with deep pockets. However, Lane J also noted that pinning recoverable costs to CPS rates might be justified if the private prosecutor makes no attempt at the outset to involve the police and/or the CPS. This therefore reinforces the importance of taking this preliminary step if clients are to be protected on costs. Awarding of costs against the defendant. Under Section 18(1) of the POA, where a person is convicted of an offence before either the Magistrates' Court or the Crown Court, the court may make such an order as to costs to be paid by the accused to the prosecutor as it considers just and reasonable. However, please note that under Section 18(4) of the POA, where any person is convicted of an offence before a magistrate's court and A, under the conviction the court orders payment of any sum as a fine, penalty, forfeiture or compensation, and B, the sums awarded to be paid does not exceed £5, then the court shall not order the accused to pay any costs under this section unless in the particular circumstances of the case he considers it right to do so. It's important to take note, firstly, any misconduct on the part of the private prosecutor and you will not get your costs. Ensure the motive is proper in bringing the private prosecution. And thirdly, ensure that the police or the CPS have the opportunity to commence proceedings. If not, you would need to be able to show why it wasn't reasonable to do so at the time. It's then perhaps interesting to compare and contrast the two cases of David Haig in 2015 with the case of Martin Porter in 2016. 2015, David Haig, the former MD of Leeds United, was ordered to pay £200,000 in costs after a failed private prosecution against a senior lawyer and two executives from his former employer, GFH Capital. He had applied for summons whilst in custody in Dubai. He was criticised by the district judge for choosing to issue a summons whilst in custody himself and for not raising his complaint with the relevant public law enforcement agencies first. Contrast that with a 2016 case involving Martin Porter, also known as the Cycling Silk, a cyclist who brought the first private prosecution for dangerous driving. He claimed he was almost knocked off his bike by a speeding Audi R8 Spider driven by driving instructor Aslan Kayadi. The police refused to charge Mr. Kayadi due to lack of evidence following an investigation, so Mr. Porter brought his own private prosecution, claiming his life had been endangered. Unfortunately for him, it took the jury just 20 minutes to acquit Mr. Kayadi at Isleworth Crown Court. However, the important point to note here is that when Porter's legal team requested that their £22,000 costs should be paid out of central funds, the judge accepted this as the private prosecution had been properly brought to court. It was neither vexatious nor malicious. Just talking briefly about compensation and confiscation. Confiscation proceedings in the Crown Court under the Proceeds of Crime Act against a convicted defendant will follow where the conditions in Section 16 of that Act are fulfilled and that either the prosecutor asks the court to proceed or the court believes it's appropriate to initiate them itself. Although the proceeds of a confiscation order will, in the ordinary court events, go to the state, the court has the power to order that a compensation order be made and paid out of the proceeds of the confiscation order. The decision to instigate confiscation proceedings should be made in the public interest and prosecuted with that interest being paramount. In considering whether to institute confiscation proceedings, the private prosecutor should explain to their client that they will have regard to any guidance periodically issued by the CPS or the Attorney General, and the court will apply the confiscation regime in a way that is compliant with Article 1 of the First Protocol to the ECHR. Early consideration must be given to applying to the Crown Court for Section 40 restraint orders, and the private prosecutor should be advised of the enhanced duty of candour expected by the court in ex parte applications. There's nothing to prevent a private prosecutor asking the court to set a confiscation timetable of assets as required. A private prosecutor should consider whether they require the assistance of an appropriate officer as defined by Section 3781 of POCA in order to fully investigate the defendant's financial circumstances. Given the experience of the police and regional asset recovery teams, it makes sense for the private prosecutor to work together with them in such matters. However, it's important to note that any agreement between the private prosecutor and an appropriate body providing an appropriate officer should be made with reference to the principle set out in the case of R versus Zynga 2014. This dealt with the issue of police funding to assist Virgin in their claim for compensation and gave rise to the perception that their independence was being compromised. The private prosecutor should ensure that any such arrangements with the police are open and adhere to relevant ACPO guidelines. Confidence in the police should be maintained by avoiding arrangements that give the impression of preference being afforded to a paying victim of crime. Interestingly, the Law Commissioner has only very recently launched a consultation on confiscation to ensure fairness of the regime. A final report with recommendations to the government is due to be published in spring 2021. So, private prosecutions. Is there an international element? Can they work abroad? While many countries, including the UK, are party to a number of bilateral and multilateral mutual legal assistance treaties, or MLAs. MLAs are a method of cooperation between states for obtaining assistance, information and documents for use in the investigation or private prosecution of criminal offences. This means that the UK can provide MLAs to any country or territory in the world to assist with their investigations and prosecutions and vice versa. Due to the increasingly global nature of crime, and MLAs are critical to criminal investigations and private prosecutors, both in the UK and abroad. However, it's important to note that the procedure for an MLA can be a slow process. Alternatively, a more efficient vehicle for obtaining disclosure is to obtain a Norwich Farmacal Order, which can be utilised to obtain disclosure of certain documents or information from third parties in international jurisdictions for use in private prosecutions commencing in the UK, but not to obtain evidence for use in overseas proceedings. Obtaining disclosure from international jurisdictions further depends on the restrictions in place within that territory. For example, the Swiss legal system permits a victim of a criminal offence who has made a criminal complaint to the authorities to use any information or documentation which is presented to the client as a result of the authorities' investigations into the alleged offence for the purposes of a private prosecution within England and Wales. Though it's important to note that disclosure in other international jurisdictions such as Iraq or Dubai is restricted due to various limitations in place. While private prosecutions are not available in every jurisdiction, many countries such as South Africa, New Zealand, France, and some states in the US also grant victims of crime the right to initiate private prosecutions to seek redress for criminal offences in their jurisdictions. So is there any regulation in respect of private prosecutors? Well, in September 2017, the Private Prosecutors Association was set up as a membership organisation to bring together professionals with expertise in private prosecutions. It subsequently published its first code for private prosecutors, the code. The intention was twofold. Firstly, to raise awareness for all those considering bringing a private prosecution. And secondly, to set out a framework of best practice for those instructed to act on their behalf. The PPA's wish was for the code to be referred to by judges and used as a benchmark document for any future private prosecutions. Although voluntary, all members of the PPA have confirmed their intention to abide by its terms. This new code followed a number of recent publicised failed private prosecutions where criticism had been levelled against those bringing these proceedings. This included bringing vexatious proceedings or simply failing to satisfy the CPS code by either not having a realistic prospect of success or not being in the public interest to bring such a matter to court. In addition, critics have for some time pointed to a lack of regulation and independence of those parties involved in bringing private prosecutions. We have also seen an increase in controversial joint inquiries with the police due to the lack of powers available for the private prosecutor. The police have also been known to approach insurance companies to contribute to the cost of an investigation. It's also been suggested that such proceedings are, due to legal aid not being available, restricting justice to wealthy individuals and private industry, and so contributing to the growth of a two-tier criminal justice system. The code provides guidance on a number of different topics, from the initial investigation stage to dealing with complex disclosure issues, through to the policy governing the recovery of costs. What is abundantly clear from the code is the requirements for the private prosecutor to act at all times with the highest standards of integrity and regard for their clients, whilst not forgetting their duties to the court to ensure proceedings are conducted fairly and justly. Interestingly, the PPA recently announced that they are to undertake a formal review of this code following the outcome of the recently announced consultation on confiscation. Simon will now look at why we are seeing more private prosecutions.
So in short, and as highlighted earlier, the increase in private prosecutions is because of the failings in the public prosecution sector and the inefficiencies in the criminal justice system as a result of the limited resources available. As we know, police budget cuts continue to bite, and there are huge pressures on the justice system, which forces businesses and individuals to fund their own actions. We can see that private prosecutions are being pursued by private law firms that include sexual offences, assaults, as well as multi-million pound fraud cases. The majority of private prosecutions involve fraud cases that are not taken on by the police or the SFO. These include cases of gold bullion fraud and Brazilian rainforest investment scams. In 2014, one leading firm estimated that up to 250 cases were being handled by the private sector. Research in 2013 by University of Portsmouth Centre for Counter Fraud Studies estimated that 98.5% of fraud cases go unreported to the police. And of the 1.5% that are reported, only 0.4% result in a criminal prosecution. The rise in private prosecutions is as a result of these inefficiencies in the system. There are no official records to show the statistics, but recent press coverage over the last weekend There are no official records to show the statistics, but recent press coverage over the recent weekend regarding the post office inquiry, which I'll come on to shortly, provides statistics that show legal aid costs being paid out of central funds in 2014 and 2015 totaled £360,000 for private prosecutions in 32 cases. By 2019-2020, those costs had risen to nearly £12.3 million in 276 cases, showing the dramatic increase in private prosecutions over the past 5 years. So if we move on to then the final slide, we're going to look at what the future holds in relation to private prosecutions. One thing is for sure, there will be a continued increase in private prosecutions. And this will create the very real prospect of a two-tier system, with cases being brought by wealthy organisations or individuals who can afford to pay the costs of a private prosecution alongside the usual CPS-driven cases. There will also be a central register for all private prosecutions. And there are concerns about the increase in unregulated private investigators carrying out inquiries on behalf of lawyers to build their cases. So we suspect that there will be some regulation of these private investigations over the coming months and years. There's also an increase in the controversial joint inquiries with the police due to the lack of powers to arrest subjects, apply for search warrants, or access criminal records. It has also been known for the police to approach insurance companies to contribute to the cost of an investigation, for example, the fake car smashes. Indeed, the Lord Chief Justice in 2014, in the case of the Crown and Virgin Media Limited and Munaf Zinga, stated, I'll do that again actually. Indeed, the Lord Chief Justice in the 2014 case of Zinga, already highlighted by Jeremy, stated that it seems inevitable that the number of private prosecutions will increase, particularly in areas relating to the criminal misuse of IP, intellectual property. In the overwhelming majority of such cases, a prosecution will serve the public interest in addressing such criminal conduct. All this points to an increase in the amount of private prosecutions being brought, and these will continue to be brought. But finally, I think it's interesting to look at the recent post office inquiry, which is currently in the news. This is an ongoing investigation regarding the post office over potential issues in relation to the bringing of private prosecutions over many years. In 2019, the post office paid a £57.75 million settlement after 555 claimants brought a group legal action in relation to the Horizon IT system, which was found to contain software flaws that caused financial shortfalls. Postmasters with unexplained losses in their branch accounts often had private prosecutions brought against them by the post office, but because the post office relied on evidence produced by the faulty Horizon system, hundreds of sub-postmasters may have been wrongly convicted of crimes they did not commit. And following this scandal, an inquiry was launched in June of this year to examine whether there are sufficient safeguards in place to limit the likelihood of injustices resulting from private prosecutions brought by organisations that act as the investigator and the prosecutor, but are also the victim of the alleged offence. And over the weekend, we saw reports in the press where MPs, on the back of the post office inquiry, have recommended that private prosecutions should be subjected to more effective safeguards so that defendants received a fair trial and do not pay excessive costs. The Justice Select Committee has warned of the danger where an alleged victim in a case is also the investigator and the prosecutor. This will apply to many scenarios where private prosecutions are taken by businesses and individuals. And this is likely to mean that the CPS's oversight role will be enhanced, and there is an enforceable code of standards for all prosecutors and investigators. In short, there will be greater regulation and greater scrutiny of private prosecutions and their prosecutors and their investigators. That being said, for now, judging by the media attention currently being given to private prosecutions, they are clearly here to stay. It is clearly noticeable that despite these times of austerity, the public are increasingly turning to private prosecutions as a means of recourse in order to achieve justice. One can only surmise that despite the costs outlay required, private prosecutions will continue to garner traction and further media attention. And that concludes this webinar, which just leaves me to say, on behalf of both Jeremy and myself, we would like to thank you for joining us today and hope you found this topic useful and informative. Please do not hesitate to get in touch should you have any questions. Thank you very much.